şıkıdım şıkıdım. Aynama şıkıdım şıkıdım. Aynama şıkıdım şıkıdım.
Ah yanardın her acayipsin.
Aynama şıkıdım şıkıdım. Aynama şıkıdım şıkıdım. Aynama şıkıdım şıkıdım.
Ah yanardın her acayipsin.
Joining us now is Sona Çapte, who's the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News and serves as the chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sona Çapte.
Glad to be with you.
And the demonstrations that are taking place in Istanbul are pretty extensive. You had 1,000 people arrested. It seems to have started out as an environmental protest, but it's sort of morphed into a kind of secular religious divide. Am I correct?
I think it's beyond that. I think this is not the typical secular versus religious Turkey. I think this is a debate over the nature and the quality of democracy in Turkey. In the last decade, the governing party in Turkey, AKP, has created a vast middle class in Turkey by implementing sound economic policies. As a result of that, for the first time in its history, Turkey has become a middle class society. Now this middle class that the governing party has created is telling this very party that has created it, well, you know, you don't have to be all my way when it comes to politics. Listen to us, listen to our views. And I think the debate over the park is emblematic of this attitude of this new middle class, which cherishes individual rights and is increasingly taking issue with the style of governance. So I think the debate in Turkey is really about style of governance and really about the path towards a liberal understanding of democracy.
But when you speak of a style of governance, when Prime Minister Erdogan talks about and has proceeded to restrict alcohol and has suggested that people who drink are automatically alcoholics, is there not a moralistic subtext here?
Indeed, there is. I think Erdogan's success has been that he has pushed aggressively free market economics, at the same time promoting an image of a family guy leader. And that worked to an extent, I think, in the sense that he delivered a lot of prosperity, and that has delivered him popularity that almost reached 50% as of the most recent elections. But at the same time, I think many Turks, even those who do not drink, do not feel comfortable with the government legislating on the issue. And this, as I said earlier, I think suggests the rise of an individualistic middle-class society where people are saying, these are our liberties, the government should not get in our way. And as a result of that, I think this is a really an interesting turn in Turkish politics. I would say Turkey is turning about to pass a threshold where it is now becoming a society in which a government, regardless of how successful it is economically, can no more dictate its vision of what a society should look like on the rest of the society without building consensus. So far, I think in the last 10 years, the Erdogan's strongman image, an image that basically meant that he could push forward policies without much regard for building consensus or creating debate, have now come to a stop. The public wants debate and wants their opinion to be taken into account. They're basically saying they might support his economic policies and they might vote for him, but he should still listen to them when implementing major policies, including policies such as building a shopping mall in downtown Istanbul. Ironically, it is the very middle class that the government has created is saying no to yet one more shopping mall. They're saying, we want our park, and this is what sparked the entire protest, as you know.
So, Sona Çapte, this government, though, has shown some sort of repressive tendencies. I mean, it's arrested an awful lot of military people, I think of some journalists as well, that is based on this preemptive idea that the military is still restive and have to be kept in their barracks. So where do civil-military relations stand at the moment?
I think in terms of that, Turkey has really come to a different universe. There was a time when the military was the kingmaker in Turkey and the political authorities simply listened to the military. That is no more the case. The government has fully subjugated the military to its power. And I think a lot of the people thought that this was the path for a liberal Turkey to emerge when they saw the civil-military relationship recalibrated. But what has come forth, although the military has disappeared from politics, is a government that has won three successive elections, has increased its political power over the spectrum, and has increasingly started to say that its vision of what Turkey should look like should be shared by all Turks. And now you're seeing a lot of Turks, including those who support the governing party, saying, you know what, it just is not right for a government to tell its citizens how to live, regardless of how successful its policies are. I think at this stage, the path forward for the AKP is to realize that it may be the most popular party in the country, but that does not mean that all its policies are popular.
Again, I'm speaking with Sona Çapte, who's the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News, and serves as the chair of the Turkish Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Initiative. Now, obviously, this government of Erdogan, the AKP party, I believe that Erdogan had very close personal relations with the Syrian dictator Assad. But then, with Assad's brutal treatment of protesters that has led to this seemingly endless and incredibly brutal civil war that's going on, it does seem that the Turkish government, and indeed Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and others, underestimated Assad's staying power. They initially seemed to think that he would fall pretty quickly in the way that the Arab Spring has played out. But the Russians are doubling down, the Iranians are, and Hezbollah are, and it looks like at this point he's holding on. What is going on then in terms of Erdogan's relationship with Syria, and the lack of response to the bombing that took place in Turkey recently, where there's been a news blackout and absolutely nothing coming from the government? So what's going on?
Well, Turkey went all the way out to confront the Assad regime's crackdown once the Damascus government basically refused to listen to Ankara's advice that it should not be using violence and it should be reforming in response to the demonstrators' demands. When that did not come forth, Turkey's policy flipped. Turkey went from being one of the closest friends of the Assad government to becoming its staunchest regional opponent, to the extent that it started to host the Syrian opposition and became a safe haven for the fighters in northern Syria. It's not an accident that most of the areas liberated by the opposition are in northern Syria, in areas next to Turkey, suggesting that Turkey's support to the rebels has made a difference. But at the same time, Turkey does not have game-changing proxies or allies in Syria whose power would suffice to topple the Assad regime. As a result of that, Turkey's Syria policy has come to a standstill, because the Assad regime is, as you say, backed by the Russians and supported and armed by the Iranians and now by Lebanese Hezbollah. Turkey does not have that kind of hard power. It can neither match the Russians' complex maneuvering in the international environment, such as at the UN, nor Iran's hard power force, such as the Hezbollah and actual militia and arms that flow to the regime. So it's finding out the shortcomings of its policy, where it wanted to push the Assad government out, and he thought that, you know, a Western alliance would build up, as well as some Arab countries, to force that regime out. But all that has not sufficed, and I think Ankara is finding out that it's too exposed, perhaps, to the Syrian conflict, as shown by the recent unfortunate terror attacks inside Turkey. So in a way, Turkey's Syria policy is showing to Turkey the very limits of Turkey's ambitions to be a Middle East player, and saying that, you know, perhaps some countries are involved in the idea of getting to become Middle East players, but it's never that easy. And even countries such as the United States had their hands burnt, and this time Turkey's realizing that maybe the Middle East is too hot for it to grasp.
So I take it, though, that intervention, even though it's unlikely, and as you have just explained, the Turkish people, I don't believe, are in support of any kind of intervention on the part of the Turkish military. But what state is the Turkish military in, given that this government has asserted control over it?
Well, this is NATO's second largest military, so it is a powerful force. But at the same time, it's a big force, but it still needs U.S. technology, hardware, things as simple as Patriot missiles, which are used for point defense. Syria has missiles. Turkey does not have technology to protect itself against those missiles, so it asked the U.S. and other NATO allies to deploy Patriot missiles in Turkey. So Turkey's military is powerful and mighty. It is the second largest. It is one of the most advanced in the region, but it nevertheless does not have the hardware to match the weapons capacity of the Assad regime and his allies, Iran and Russia. So I think that has pushed Turkey's military, but also the government, to pivot further to the U.S. in search of security assistance, security guarantees that Turkey will not be exposed to the fallout of the Syria war should the Assad regime decide to provoke Ankara into a conflict or target Turkey. And I think as a result of that, you've seen closer ties between Turkey and U.S. than has been the case for at least a decade. The Syrian war has pushed the two countries closer together.
And what about its relations with Israel, which used to be close and have obviously got incredibly frayed by the Israeli commando attack on the Turkish ship that killed a number of Turks?
We have seen an uptick in Turkish-Israeli ties, and that too is related to the war in Syria, just as the significant improvement in Turkish-American ties is mostly related to Syria, in the sense that Syria projects a similar kind of threat to both Turks and Israelis, the idea of a failed state, a Somalia-style failed state that would be an incubator for radical groups that borders both Turkey and Syria. That this is a regime that has chemical weapons that could proliferate and fall into wrong hands is a threat to both Turkey and Syria. So the two countries are finding out that they may have had disagreements in the past, but it is time for them to get over that and talk to each other once again. At the same time, I think U.S. President Obama's intervention to bring the Turkish and Israeli leaders together so they would work together again and start talking was useful in bringing forward Turkish-Israeli rapprochement. It's not to say that Turkish-Israeli ties are going to go back to what they were in the 1990s, when they were very intimate security, military ties and cooperation, but it is to say that this is going to be a new relationship that will have some significant elements that will include cooperation on Syria, that will include a significant amount of trade. Ironically, or perhaps not so ironically, because Turkey and Israel are the two most developed economies in the region, despite the downturn in political ties, Turkish-Israeli economic ties are booming, and they actually were increasing at a higher pace. Trade was increasing at a higher pace after the 2010 flotilla incident than it was before. So one could see where trade remains and becomes an even more important component of the relationship. Syria is an important area of cooperation, though the two countries will continue to have areas of disagreement, such as Turkey and Israel will diverge on how to deal with Hamas, and as well as perhaps some other regional issues. But I think overall, this is not a no relationship, but it is rather a new relationship in the wake of the Arab Spring between Turks and Israelis.
So, Sona Kapche, tell me, though, about you're suggesting that Erdogan's got some blowback in effect for bringing up and nurturing a Turkish middle class, and now they're sort of turning on him. But what explains the very brutal reaction of the police, the heavy-handed nature of what he seems to be doing, and give us a sense in terms of his religiosity in the American context? You know, we have the Republican Party in this country is clearly influenced by the religious right, but I think it's still a fairly secular country. But in terms of religion and politics, it's pretty clear that people that are religious think in very absolute terms. They're not necessarily very tolerant, and they certainly aren't given to any nuance. So is there an inherent problem? Is there an inherent divide here between the secular, the young Turks in particular, who seem to want to live a kind of a Western-style life, this man who's talking about family values
I don't think this is a secular versus religious divide. I think this is a divide about style of governance. What has worked in Turkey for the last decade and before that was the idea that a strongman, sort of like Latin America, would be elected democratically and then could kind of do whatever he or she wanted because they were elected, and elected people can get to do what they want. That is no more the case in Turkey. I think what you're seeing in Turkey, not about religion, not about secularism, it is about the fact that a lot more people are now saying democracy is not just winning elections, it is also building consensus. And the fact that the government dismissed this, what looked like a mini protest over a park in downtown Istanbul and used violence to crack down on it, brought tens of thousands of people in the middle of the night to Istanbul's downtown at 3 a.m. in the morning. People said, you know what, that's not how democracy is supposed to work out. And people are basically saying that this is supposed to be a style of governance where democratically elected governments, however popular they are, cannot dismiss public opinion when it comes to major social or political projects. And I think this is going to be Turkey's new turn from now on.
But this is not to say then that Erdogan's is he not motivated by a kind of absolutism that comes along with people who are religious?
I don't see the relationship. I think Erdogan is a leader who thinks that he has majority vote, and majority vote means that he can basically implement his political projects on the rest of the society. And I think democracy is not majoritarianism. It is not rule of majority, rule by majority. It is also protection of the rights of the minorities and different groups, and also the idea of egalitarian values. And I think we're basically seeing what we could be seeing in most other democratic systems, where someone who comes to power with overwhelming support and stays in power through consecutive terms decides to think that they can dismiss public opinion. And I think in Turkey, this is increasingly not proving to be the case.
And this, just in closing, this could lead, do you think, to a revival of the opposition?
It all depends. There are people in the opposition who want to cast this ideologically. As I said earlier, if this is cast to be made a secular versus religious divide, it will not work. I think we are going to see whether or not the demonstrations stay around or fizzle out. We are going to see a new awareness in Turkey on issues such as the environment, such as urban heritage, such as individual liberties. And I think this is going to be the new push against the governing party, which has pretty much had a free ride in the last 10 years. Because it had delivered phenomenal economic growth by making Turkey one of the G20 countries and tripling Turkey's income per capita and making Turkey as economy larger than most European economies, it thought that it could kind of move forward with any policies, social or political, without the need to build consensus and promote debate. Because it delivered growth and because it made the Turks wealthy, I think, ironically, a lot of the Turks are saying, yes, you made us wealthy, but now listen to us and make sure that getting elected and being popular does not mean that you get to do everything you want, but also listen to our views. So I think, to me, this is the Turkish democracy passing a test. It is saying that it is, in fact, the modernization theory working. The modernization theory says that when societies become majority middle class, they do become democratic in a rather entrenched fashion, and maybe this is exactly what's happening in Turkey.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sona Çapcay.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sona Çapcay, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News and serves as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Initiative. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about a new Cold War between the United States and a combination of China and Russia.